We're talking about anger in this hour, and there's a lot of it right now, all over the world. Terror attacks in Europe, hate crimes in the U.S., populist leaders everywhere spouting nationalist slogans that just a few years ago would have been unthinkable. Writer Pankaj Mishra traces the roots of contemporary political rage back to a kind of surprising source, the 18th century Enlightenment. Steve Paulson caught up with him to talk about his new book, The Age of Anger.
You have written a very timely book here with the election of Donald Trump, the Brexit vote, all the populist movements springing up around Europe. But you trace the politics of anger way back to the Enlightenment thinkers of the 18th century. Why do we need to know this history to understand our current political moment?
I do think we need to reacquaint ourselves with that history, with this particular history, and re-examine the ideals of the modern world as they were formulated in the late 18th century, mainly by the Enlightenment philosophers, the ideals of liberty, equality, of commerce, of trade, the pursuit of wealth, of intellectual sophistication.
And then this was the period that really kind of booted the church out of the governing values of our society, and marketplace values came in as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is the crucial change. And I think we really absolutely have to understand what happened there was that we moved away from older forms of hierarchy and authority and embarked upon this extraordinarily radical adventure of using human reason to build society and to define its laws and to define the rules of political community. This was the great adventure that we embarked upon back then. So if we are examining political anger, which is pretty much universal today, then we have to go back to that moment when we started to liberate ourselves from the church, from traditional religion, from the authority of divinely ordained kings and that kind of thing.
Well, let's go back to the beginning of the Enlightenment, when this dream of a modern rational state was first articulated by two French philosophers who were rivals, Voltaire and Rousseau. They had diametrically opposed ideas about what a good society should be, and you suggest that to a certain extent, we're still stuck in their arguments.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, those differences are absolutely crucial, I feel, to understanding where we are today, because in many ways they kind of map onto our contemporary divisions between the metropolitan elite and the angry, disaffected masses who blame the elites for their suffering and for their plight. Voltaire, I mean, I think, you know, someone who advocates free trade, who's all for commerce, who wants free speech, at least for himself and for the intellectuals, doesn't have much time for the masses, doesn't really have much time for people essentially belonging to social classes inferior than his, but very extremely ambitious. He believes that he's kind of found the right kind of formula for moving on from older forms of hierarchy and authority. And then you have Rousseau, who's from Geneva, an outsider in Paris, who feels slighted, who feels humiliated by this sort of glamorous world of the Parisian elites, among which, you know, the Enlightenment philosophers revolve. And he thinks that these new ideals of status, of wealth, of vanity, competitiveness, are going to leave human beings extremely unhappy, and they're going to cause deep internal conflicts, which turns out that he was not entirely wrong.
Hmm. And these were contemporaries, Voltaire and Rousseau, and they hated each other, didn't they?
They hated each other for all kinds of reasons. I mean, there was a, you know, great class divide between the two, and temperamentally they were very, very different. Rousseau, of course, had a lot of what we would identify today as psychological problems. He was a very peculiar man in many ways. Voltaire was a man of the world, you know, extremely cultured, urbane, a great socialite, a great lover of wealth, a great lover of powerful people. Rousseau hated all that. He disliked rich people. He did not want to be in the company of powerful people. He avoided their company, in fact. So very different in all kinds of ways, and also, most importantly, different in their views of the good life or what the good life consists of.
Well, I'm curious about your take on this new era that we have, the politics of anger, or you could call it the politics of resentment, because my sense is that even though you're clearly not sympathetic to, say, the Brexit vote or the election of Donald Trump, at least I don't think you are, my sense is that you have some sympathy for this politics of resentment.
I think that's a fair summary of my attitudes. And, you know, I think one reason one is compelled, in a way, to feeling sympathy for those positions, you know, even though I'm not at all sympathetic to the Brexiteers, and needless to say, nor do I love Donald Trump, but I can understand why people voted for him or why people voted for Brexit. I do think we have to make an effort to understand the rage and despair and frustration that drove people, many people, into making these unwise political choices. And without that act of sympathetic understanding, I think we'll simply perpetuate these divisions between the aloof, metropolitan, technocratic elites and the masses who feel that these elites are simply feathering their own nests, who are engaged in this project of self-aggrandizement and leaving everyone else behind, and not just behind, but kind of pushing them behind and disdaining them and scorning them. And you know, these are the polarities that we see today in the United States and many other countries today. You kind of, almost a kind of civil war, low-intensity civil war.
Now, there is a different explanation for the rise of Trump and the people who supported Brexit and these emerging nationalist movements in Europe, the right-wing movements, and that's the reaction to fundamentalist Islam, to the threat of terrorism in Europe and the Middle East, this is what they are there to protect us against those forces.
Well, I think that was a catastrophic mistake that many of us made after 9/11. We were obsessed with Islam. People made entire careers out of our portraying Islam as a religion that seems to offer a special legitimacy to acts of violence. And
well, there certainly are still a lot of people who say that.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a whole industry out there, and it's very well funded by all kinds of institutions, shady people. Billions of dollars have been spent on this. But, you know, intellectually, it's a dead end. Terrorism has a long history, which has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with specific socioeconomic pressures, which become intolerable at certain times. And the people who find those pressures intolerable often resort to terroristic violence. And, you know, you can trace this history right back to the late 19th century, to the Russians, to the Spaniards, to the Italians, who first resorted to anarchist violence or terroristic violence. And there were no Muslim terrorists in sight back then. What we have seen in recent years is not just terrorism in Muslim countries, but also in Buddhist countries, among Sikh populations. We've seen that among the Hindu majority population of India. So it is certainly not particular to any religious community. I've just come back from spending a month in Myanmar, where Buddhist monks are leading ethnic cleansing mobs. Now, how does one explain that? Does Buddhism sanction violence? The answer is no, of course not.
And you take the argument even further. I mean, sort of the kind of the radical thing that you say is there's actually a lot of similarity between some of these fundamentalist religious groups and the nationalist groups you see popping up in the U.S. and Europe. To some degree, they're both reacting against sort of this move towards modernism, and none of them like it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the argument of the book is that we have to look beyond binary oppositions, Islam versus the West, liberalism versus Islam, or the West versus the East. We have to really start thinking of the world as, you know, constituted by sameness. And so if you're a white nationalist in the United States or in Scandinavia, if you're an unemployed Muslim graduate in Egypt or a poorly paid wage slave in India, what unites all these experiences is a sort of shared feeling of powerlessness, of humiliation, of marginality, of exclusion. This is what we should be focusing on.
So to come back to the promise of the Enlightenment, I mean, this was supposed to deliver humanity, the modern world, into this new age that was, you know, going to be more rational, be more humanistic, not going to sort of follow the old outdated rules of the church. But a lot of that promise seems unfulfilled. And I guess the question is, so where does that leave us?
This is where I feel it's imperative to examine the ideals of the Enlightenment more closely. I mean, you know, we've allowed ourselves to be dazzled by them. We have started worshiping them as a kind of substitute god.
What do you think we're worshiping?
Well, I think, you know, simply saying that progress is irreversible, is inevitable, and now we have embarked upon this path of equality and liberty and prosperity, and that more and more people are going to be benefiting. This is a kind of fantasy that, especially in the last three decades, has become very, very intoxicating for many people. But can we actually realize them without running huge risks, political risks? And of course, we haven't even talked about the great threat to the environment, the fact that the ideals of prosperity that have been realized by a tiny minority of Europeans and Americans, are they really fulfillable for the hundreds of millions, billions literally, of Indians and Chinese who also want them?
Right. And of course, globalization was supposed to lift all boats, right? I mean, it was supposed to make everyone prosper.
This is what I'm saying. Like, you know, we are looking at utterly fantastical projects. You know, we've moved into a realm of total fantasy with these notions that globalization, I mean, these are just empty metaphors. You know, globalization is going to lift all boats. There's going to be trickle down, and, you know, the benefits of economic growth will eventually be available to all. Well, the anger today, so much of it arises from the fact that these promises were false. And, you know, there was no way these promises were going to be fulfilled. So, you know, here we are in a kind of impasse, really, where so much of what we believed in has been exposed as essentially false.
Pankaj Mishra, he's the author of Age of Anger, A History of the Present. Steve Paulson talked with him.